Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced by WEKU at Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. There's a great analysis of what's been happening to local news across Appalachia, why it's so vital, and what the future looks like for local news in the region. Jim Branscombe and Bill Bishop wrote it, and Jim Branscombe walks us through the findings. And a special event coming up in Lexington's Isaac Murphy Memorial Art Garden featuring a homecoming of New York-based, Lexington-born and raised jazz trumpeter Michael Cruz. First, for nearly three decades, Renee Shaw has been one of the people Kentuckians have turned to when we wanted to understand our politics, our problems, our communities, and sometimes maybe more so lately, actually, one another. Renee joined Kentucky Educational Television 29 years ago and went on to become KET's Director of Public Affairs and one of its most familiar on-air journalists, hosting Kentucky Tonight, Kentucky Edition, Connections, election coverage, and numerous public forums. Now Renee Shaw has retired from KET, and rather than simply look back over a long resume, I thought I'd ask her what nearly three decades of listening, questioning, and watching Kentucky have taught her. Renee, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure. And thank you for all the great work that you do now and have done. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So much. I appreciate that. You've spent a remarkable portion of your adult life professionally observing Kentucky, its politics, its institutions, its people. How has that changed your understanding of Kentucky?
What I have learned most about Kentucky, and you alluded to it toward the end, is it's not just a series of intractable problems that you may recall that former University of Kentucky President Lee Todd had the lexicon that Kentucky is at the top of every ugly list and at the bottom of every good list, and he called it the Kentucky Uglies, right? And I have seen Kentucky make great strides when it comes to educational progress. I've seen us grow in terms of economic development and jobs. And there are still pockets of our state that are still mired and moored into poverty and has been that way for many, many decades. But the state is moving forward, I believe, in a very positive direction. But we still face a lot of challenges. But we have also climbed out of some of the depths of despair of the opioid addiction crisis. We started in full with that about 20-something years ago, and it went full tilt. And we know now that with all kinds of mitigation measures and public policy, that more lives are being saved and snatched from the grip of addiction. Our whole thinking has evolved about addiction recovery and what that looks like, not a whole one-size-fits-all approach, but an individualistic look at that. So I look at all the challenges that Kentucky has faced in my 29 years of close observation. But what I really hang my hat on is the people who really try to make a difference. And it's not always the folks in Frankfort. There are folks who are at the community level, the grassroots level, who are really getting involved and doing what they can to make a difference in very meaningful ways, not always small ways as we like perhaps maybe think of how people can get involved, but in very magnanimous ways, whether it's educational spaces or child welfare or what have you, that I've seen the collective spirit, the unbridled spirit of Kentuckians, and I've been able to witness that over the last 29-plus years.
I think one of the privileges of working for a statewide institution like KET must be that your Kentucky isn't limited to Frankfort or to Lexington or Louisville. You've encountered Eastern Kentucky, Western Kentucky, small towns, cities, Black communities, rural communities, wealthy communities, places struggling economically. What do Kentuckians misunderstand about one another, do you think?
Oh, that's such a great question. And I think that sometimes, particularly our ecosystem of media doesn't help that, with social media kind of exacerbates our divides, whether it's politically or geographically. It doesn't really help advance, squelching xenophobia. All of those things allow us to kind of self-cluster ourselves in what is familiar. But I think what we don't understand is how much we do have in common, right? That even though there are all these different segments of the population, that if you struggle financially in the west end of Louisville, you struggle also financially in the eastern parts of the state, that poverty is poverty, that low income is low income. And so there are lots of ways that there are similarities. And I think, you know, I see that more, that the problems aren't just divided along ethnic, racial, geographic lines. I think what perhaps many people who live in the rural parts of the state may look at a place like Louisville, and it becomes almost a separate state, mm-hmm. right? Not just because of the skyline is different, but just not understanding how urban dynamics tend to work. And the same could be said on a lower level about Lexington. But also, we have to understand that folks in Louisville and Lexington need to understand that there's a whole part of the state that is west of 65, right? And to try to understand the agricultural assets and culture that is part of our heritage. And so I think there's a lot of learning that we all need to do to get out of our own bubbles to understand our neighbors. And that's the one thing, Tom, as you know, about being a journalist, it widens the aperture in which you see the world, that you are your opportunities to talk with people that you would think on the surface you have nothing in common with, to just have a dialogue about what are your hopes and dreams. And you'll find that they resemble your own. And so I think that's one thing that public media can do, particularly on a statewide level, is help bridge those divides some, where we do understand a little bit more about each other and not judge one another. But there are far more similarities in how we live and what we believe and what we want out of life, regardless of where we are in the state.
In these roles, we tend to concentrate on the problems, and that's mm-hmm. because problems require attention, need to be solved. But after doing that for about 30 years, what do you think Kentucky doesn't give itself enough credit for?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think resiliency. If we even look at the issue of how the state has had to deal with the uptick in natural disasters in recent years, and we had a spate of those in western Kentucky and in eastern Kentucky, where we've seen the communities come together to rally around one another, I think that's what I don't want to say we don't give ourselves enough credit for. I think lots of times we think people on the outside don't give us enough credit for what we do. But I think resiliency is one major attribute of Kentuckians, that grit and stick-to-itiveness. In the hardest of times, people do rally themselves and others in times of great stress and distress. And I've seen that time and time again. And even when it's not a natural disaster, but everyday life, I've seen folks really care about their neighbor. So I don't know if it's viewed as widely, that there is a lot of compassion that Kentuckians have, that they care about their neighbors, they care about their communities. And so I don't think we give ourselves enough credit for that. From the public policy perspective, I think it's easy to kind of root ourselves down into headlines about educational setbacks when we know that there is a good subtext that says that we are making strides in numeracy and literacy, and that we are getting to where we were pre-COVID. So there's a lot of educational gains, and we are even developing on a higher end front. More Kentuckians have advanced or post-secondary education degrees than they had several years ago. So I think we don't give ourselves enough credit for what we are doing. And we do look at the complexity of the problems and think they're intractable. But there are a lot of good solutions that are proving to work. There's a lot of good models at work. But it takes time. You know, as you know, when you create a policy, you don't get the result in the next year. It takes a while to see that come to fruition, at its full fruition. And so I think Kentucky is on a great path, and we need to give ourselves credit for our grit and our resiliency and our ability to show compassion when compassion is needed.
There's a particular kind of silence that you're known for.
Okay.
A guest says something combative, maybe, something half-true, something clearly meant to provoke. And for 1 or 2 seconds, you say nothing. Mm-hmm. And for about 30 years, that silence and what came after it was about as close as I think we came to having a referee. Where did that pause come from?
Oh,
was
wow.
it taught, or did you have to unlearn the instinct to fill silence? Because we sure have that.
We sure have that. And you are so right that instinctively we feel like we've got to fill space in whatever capacity that is. But when you are moderating a conversation, and you know this, you want to allow the conversation to breathe. I want to make sure that I've actually understood what that person has said. So sometimes that pregnant pause isn't because of something inflammatory or something that I disagree with. Sometimes it just needs to land a little longer in the gray matter for me to think, okay, I may not get to this right now, but I'm going to write something down. So that's often what you don't see off camera, is that I'm taking notes during a Kentucky Tonight or a candidate appearance or forum to say, I'm going to come back to that because I'm going to noodle over that a little bit to make sure that I formulate the right question to get to the answer that will deepen the understanding. Because I always like to think if I question it, then someone else is questioning it as well. Now, there are times, Tom, there have been some things said that I've questioned, one, whether it's truth or valid or fair, accurate, necessary. But, you know, I have learned in those moments to, as my mother would say, fix your face and also give myself some pause so that I don't actually have my mouth say what my mind is thinking, because I have always been very conscious that my role has not been to editorialize, to provide commentary, that my role was just to concentrate on the facts and the analysis thereof and to make sure that all the different stakeholders as possible convened in one space had equal and fair time to express themselves.
You have done that, and that's what you're known for. And a great deal of your work at KET involved putting people who profoundly disagreed with one another around the same table and asking them to talk to each other, which seems radical to the point of almost dangerous now. What did you learn about disagreement from watching it at such close range over those years?
Well, one is to think through before you speak. That's the first thing. And I would hope that maybe some of the guests would have exercised that a little bit more at times. But I always looked at a program like Kentucky Tonight is offering a platform for those who are for or against an issue to learn from each other. I mean, I can have one way of looking at an issue and think that that's absolutely right if it goes unchallenged. But until I hear the opposition, I can't formulate a stronger position and solidify that with more evidence and facts and data. And it causes, I would think, a person to get even more on their A game, to be challenged, to make sure that they can answer the criticism before it is even launched. I mean, I think what it's taught me is the art of the argument, that the crafting of an argument. And I tried to maintain the civility. I've actually had to call out a couple of times when it got a little bit more heated than I would have preferred and had to say calmly, you know, let's stay on task. But I'm hoping that during all of that exchange that both of those people or however many were there learned from each other and then perhaps greater and better or more well-rounded public policy came from that discussion because other perspectives were heard. I mean, that's what Kentucky Tonight is about. It's not always for and against. Sometimes it's very nuanced in how people view a particular issue. And so it's kind of the stakeholders who have something involved, something at stake. And I'm hoping that through all those years that I did Kentucky Tonight and Bill Goodman, my predecessor before, you know, the role was to allow that conversation to freely happen so that we all learned and perhaps we had a deeper understanding of what that complex issue was about and how to move forward from that point on.
Television creates a particular kind of performance.
Mm-hmm.
Politicians come in practiced at it. Advocates become practiced at it.
Yes.
Even journalists do.
That's right.
Could you tell when somebody came into the set determined to perform a version of themselves rather than have an honest conversation? And could you ever get them out of that mode?
Sure, absolutely. Well, that happens a lot in the candidate space, right? That, you know, you can look back at any Kentucky Tonight in which we had opposing candidates and you can see where they are going to be on very scripted message, regardless of the question that is posed and regardless of any the many iterations of that question that is posed, that it's very hard to get a very tactical politician off message. And that can be a frustration that media have in dealing with politicians. My job was never to ambush or to demean or to poke. My job had always been to just get truth And as much as they're going to tell it, and I assume that the audience is wise enough, intelligent enough to know when a candidate is dodging a question, that I didn't have to keep going at it to prove that I was doing my job. I would push at a certain point and maybe restate the question or go back to it after a period of time. But I assumed that the viewer had enough intelligence to pick up what that candidate was putting down or not, and that they could decide for themselves whether or not that's someone they could trust and that that's someone for whom they would vote. It was never my job to advocate for the moderator to overly insert myself into those conversations. Sometimes I let things breathe when candidates were going at it, and I thought, okay, I'm going to give this 2 minutes to let them have this exchange, because that's going to demonstrate temperament when challenged, not just by a moderator, but by the opposition. Sometimes they perceive the moderator as the opposition. But I think those things are very telling. It's not just what a candidate or a politician or an advocate says. It's how they respond in the moment, which I think can be equally informing to a viewer about whether or not that person is trustworthy and someone with whom they should vote for.
You should teach this stuff.
I don't know about all that. I still have a lot to learn.
Well, your career has placed you in rooms and positions, particularly earlier in your career. There weren't many Black women occupying those roles in Kentucky journalism. You've received a good deal of recognition for being a trailblazer. But I'm interested in what that actually felt like.
Yeah.
Were there times when you felt you had to earn the presumption of authority in a way that some of your colleagues didn't?
Yeah. I said this to another journalist a few weeks back, that when I first arrived at the state capitol in 1997, you know, I was a poli-sci major and a broadcast journalism major and had a master's in organizational communication. But none of that prepared me to actually be at 700 Capitol Avenue and that grand capitol and in that environment. And I was really intimidated by it. But what I tried not to do, Tom, was to walk in and presume that anyone looked at me differently because of who I was, a woman, African American, that I assumed that they thought the best of me as I thought of them. And what I did, though, is I brought to bear a level of professionalism and how I approached them and the job that I did and the shows that I produced and the conversations that I had, whether that was on or off camera, one, to show my humanity, one, to show that there is a lot of likeness than there are differences. I mean, I think that that's part of what journalists do. It's not just what you see as the deliverable, whether that's the show or the podcast. Sometimes it's the conversation behind the scenes to cultivate that trust. And I worked really hard at making sure that I was viewed as someone who was trustworthy. When you told me something was off the record, I still have that and will take that to my grave, and they could count on that. And so I did feel the weight of being one of the only African Americans at that time early on in my career to be at the state capitol in a journalism capacity. But I did not become, you know, mired by that, where I wanted to focus on performance and to show that the next thing I did was going to be the better thing and the best thing that I did. And it didn't matter whether I was Black or female or not. I am proud that I have been able to maybe, quote, blaze a trail or two. And I see a lot more African Americans and people of color trying to occupy that space, whether it's the state capitol or the nation's capitol. So I'm glad that there is more openings for that to occur. And I don't take a lot of credit for doing that beyond Kentucky, but I am glad to see that representative government is also represented in the truth tellers who talk about government. And I think that's really important. So I've wanted to be a representative of my family, of who I am, where I come from, of my faith, and anything else, you know, I can't take a lot of credit for. I'm just glad to have been in that space for as long as I was.
This question might be a little premature because you just retired, so maybe haven't thought about this yet, but I wonder if you have. And there's something kind of curious about journalism, about what we do.
Right.
For years, the professional instinct is to notice things, ask questions, pursue the next story, whatever's coming up. Can you turn it off?
You cannot. I mean, when I was just on vacation out of state, you know, there were things all around me thinking, oh, that would be a really good story. I mean, intellectual curiosity is part of a journalist's whole DNA. That's what drives you, is the fact that you want to know what that is, why it exists, how long, where did it come from. Instinctively, you go to the questions and you want to learn and you want to know more. So you don't become an unjournalist just because you retire from a space. I will always be a journalist. And even though I'm taking this temporary pause and I don't know what's next, I will still always carry the journalist Hippocratic Oath. You know, Robert McNeil and Jim Lehrer kind of had these 10 commandments about how to comport yourself when you're a journalist. And one is to perceive the viewer, the listener, as intelligent as I am, and to perceive them as a good as person as I am, that you don't need to unnecessarily assail their character, that their private matters are their private matters until they interfere with the public space and the office in which they hold, and that we are not in the entertainment business, right? And I think that's a little fluttery right now about whether journalists and influencers, those lines are being muddied. But I will always be a journalist. And this pause that I take in my career is just to reset to the next thing. And who knows what that is?
Well, you've spent much of your career asking other people what they think, what they believe, what they want, what worries them, what they hope will happen next. So I'm going to give you one of your own questions.
Oh, goodness. Oh, boy.
At this moment in your life, Renee Shaw,
yeah.
What are you curious about?
Oh, goodness. What am I not curious about? Well, one, this is silly. It's going to seem pickleball. Like, I've never made time to do that. I tried it over the weekend. I'm not very good at it. I'm curious about some of the simple things, that I've overlooked or hadn't made time for. My family genealogy. You know, this time that I'm spending as my parents' age and I'm trying to spend more time with them, you know, to sort out life's things. And so there's lots that I'm trying to unpack from my family genealogy and my ancestors who left things behind. You know, I'm really interested in curating all of those items, their journals, their recipe books, all of those things, and hopefully compiling that into something that will honor what they sacrificed so that I could have a much better life. And so I'm really curious about what I have taken for granted. And that right now is my family history and genealogy and what my ancestors left behind for me to cherish, because I haven't always done a good job of honoring that. And I hope to make amends.
Renee Shaw, I think I'm speaking for Kentuckians who followed you for almost 30 years, that we're really looking forward to seeing where that remarkable curiosity and talent take you next.
Thank you, sir. I am too.
Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Across Appalachia, newspapers that once chronicled public life, challenged powerful interests, and preserved a community's memory are disappearing. The few remaining papers are surviving with only a fraction of their former reporting staffs. In their essay, The Hollowing of the Appalachian Press from Pittsburgh to Birmingham, Jim Branscombe and Bill Bishop argue that this decline is more than a crisis for journalism. It's part of a larger pattern of economic extraction, population loss, and weakening public accountability across the region. And Jim Branscombe joins us now. Jim, welcome back to Eastern Standard.
Thanks, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
You begin in this essay with the story of the Mountain Eagle in Whitesburg, Kentucky, whose offices were destroyed by arson in 1974 after years of aggressive reporting on local government and the coal industry. Its publisher at the time, Tom Gish, responded by changing the paper's motto from "It Screams" to "It Still Screams." Why was that the right place to begin this larger story about the Appalachian Press?
What Tom and Pat Gish were doing at that newspaper was doing what the First Amendment requires that newspapers do, and that's stand as a bulwark against a bad government. You know, Thomas Jefferson's famous quote was that even though newspapers attacked him pretty viciously, he said if he had a choice between government without newspapers or newspapers without government, he would take the newspapers without government because of the role that he viewed they played in keeping government accountable. And the Mountain Eagle is the right place to start because the sunshine open meeting laws that exist in Kentucky today were revised in part because of what had happened to the reporting careers of Tom and Pat Gish. Tom was a Letcher County boy who graduated from University of Kentucky Journalism and was working in Frankfort as a Forest Service reporter. And when he had an opportunity to come back to Whitesburg and buy the local paper, Pat had been a reporter at the Lexington Leader. And they expected what every enterprising journalist expects, that all the meetings would be open and they would be invited in and be allowed to report. And that wasn't what happened. And the school boards and other government agencies in Whitesburg were not accustomed to having reporters present. And so they started banning them and making threats and the usual things that happened. And in 1974, the paper was burned. And why this matters is that it turns out it wasn't the coal industry or the strip miners that Tom had been opposing editorially. It was local policemen who's paid some young boys to pour kerosene on the press building. And he got a very light sentence. Actually, never served any jail time. And then a decade or so later, this policeman files to run for office. And when Ben Gish, the son of the owners, put that notice in the paper, the person resigned. So the significance is if you don't have an open local press, the arsonist sometimes runs for office and gets elected.
Well, the Eagle survived that overt attempt to silence it, but you suggest in the essay that the threat facing local newspapers today may be less dramatic, but maybe more difficult to resist. What's different about this quieter form of destruction?
The disappearance of the press just means that the basic information that people need to exercise good citizenship is just not there. And governments more and more try to get away from obeying the sunshine laws. A good example is the data centers. These data center agreements that the county supervisors and city authorities are signing with the Silicon Valley data center people frequently require that they be kept secret. And it's only because of some enterprising reporting and local citizens' investigations that we know some of these data centers, which have enormous impact on the communities, are being planned.
One of the essay's central arguments is that the loss of local journalism and the economic hollowing out of Appalachian communities are not separate problems. You describe them as parts of one machine. How does population loss weaken a newspaper, and how might the loss of a newspaper, in turn, make a community's decline harder to reverse?
Those phenomena are all joined at the hip, Tom. When the population declines, there's less circulation opportunity. When the population declines, probably some of the grocery stores or some of the retail operations that advertise drop their advertising. So cumulatively, the community that is losing population or facing economic decline, which needs information more than ever, is the one that has the least of it. So there's a direct connection. Economic decline and the decline of newspapers and news reporting are two connected things.
You know, you point out, and this was interesting to me, you point out that statewide figures, can make some Appalachian states appear relatively well-served by journalists. But when you look county by county, especially in the coal fields, the picture becomes much more alarming. What disappears when we rely on those statewide numbers?
Our numbers showed, Tom, that 80% of the counties without any newspaper coverage at all are tend to be in rural areas. So when we look at journalism equivalents, which a couple of organizations do, when you look at Lexington or Louisville, for example, it looks like statewide Kentucky is pretty well saturated with journalists. But you move into the mountains and what you discover is that the papers have just disappeared. And there may be a newspaper masthead there that purports to be a newspaper, but the truth is there's no reporter behind it. It's just a website with maybe a news story pulled from social media or from a wire service account somewhere. And we call those those newspapers.
What distinguishes a living local newspaper, those that are left, from a ghost paper?
Actually having a reporter on the ground who does go to school board meetings and county government meetings and presents the information that doesn't otherwise get reported. You know, a local newspaper will do something that doesn't otherwise get reported. If your neighbor gets indicted, a good newspaper, a local newspaper will report your neighbor and stand against the complaints it gets. And that simply doesn't happen in a place where your information is controlled by government agencies.
Well, can a publication still look familiar to readers, the same name, same masthead, maybe even the same delivery schedule, while no longer performing the essential work of journalism?
That's one of the downsides of the internet and websites, Tom, is you can put up a masthead and pretend to be a newspaper based in a local county and take advertising and report the temperature and the weather from a water service or some other outfit. And truth be told, there's no reporter whatsoever based in the local area to report on the vital things that all of us won't report it on.
You draw a parallel between newspaper chains and hedge funds buying up local papers and absentee corporations extracting coal and other wealth out of Appalachia. What do you believe that that comparison can help us understand?
The hedge funds and private equity buy up assets and lay off employees and extract the money that's and capital that's present in the business. And the same thing happens when the monopoly press in the country takes over newspapers. They lay off a large percentage of the staff and take a lot of the capital that's there and leave the local paper with very limited number of staff, or in some cases, not at all, and become a coast newspaper.
The essay cites evidence that communities without adequate news coverage might face higher public borrowing costs and a weaker deterrence against corruption. In other words, the disappearance of journalism can carry a measurable financial and government cost. Should local journalism be understood as a form of civic infrastructure, something comparable, let's say, in principle anyway, to a library, a road, or maybe a public utility?
That's exactly what our data in the article showed, Tom. The economic studies have been done, and the communities that don't have a newspaper pay a higher cost on municipal bonds. They pay a higher interest rate and have less favorable terms. And that applies across a broad spectrum of community health and the local economic business that the government conducts. So the newspaper is a vital part of good civic behavior.
You write that understaffing can cause the mountains to be portrayed primarily as a place where things go wrong. And I think this is going to resonate with a lot of folks. Is the loss of local journalism also a loss of a community's ability to describe itself properly?
Yes, that's the other thing that that is dramatic and very, very concerning, Tom. It's easy to do crime reporting because the police are always usually helpful in reporting what their officers have done. So the crime reporting is the easiest thing a newspaper can do. And most young journalists cut their teeth in reporting on the police and the courts. And so that becomes, in a lot of communities with a limited number of reporters, that becomes the news. So you read all about the car wrecks and the robberies and almost nothing about what else is going on in the community. So it's a part of what's been going on for centuries or more to depict the Appalachian region as an area of people that don't behave well.
Well, we know that there are some pretty encouraging experiments going on out there. In fact, WEKU is involved in some of this, things like nonprofit newsrooms, public media collaborations, community efforts to purchase newspapers from chains. And you use the term replanting, putting a local news institution back into local hands. What would successful replanting look like in a small Appalachian county?
A good example is what's happened in with the Woodford News. A newspaper could be become a nonprofit and operate under the terms of nonprofit status and hire reporters and prove out a new model The Appalachian Funders Network, along with the MacArthur Foundation, have done some innovative thinking about what can happen if there isn't a local newspaper and or a local news reporting entities, and thinking through how the governments can be more favorable through tax policies or otherwise, and allow a newspaper to operate as a non-profit rather than a profitable enterprise.
So to sum up, Jim, what can we reasonably expect to happen in our community when nobody is watching and reporting on civic affairs, on schools, on social life, and of course on crime?
I think we can expect less responsive government. You know, Kentucky's had an interesting history in this. You know, Brandeis was a Supreme Court justice who coined the term sunshine. He called sunshine a disinfectant, and having a First Amendment that works and having a newspaper that can report on the local government is key to opportunity for have not only good government, but good citizenship. And, you know, it's encouraging that there's so much good thinking going on and funding is becoming available to rethink how we do news in 21st century. When we have so much disinformation or misinformation that's been reported in social media, having an independent press, whether it's for-profit or non-profit, makes a lot of difference in the kind of governments we're going to have going forward.
Jim Branscombe is the co-author with Bill Bishop of The Hollowing of the Appalachian Press from Pittsburgh to Birmingham. And given our time limitation here, we only skim the surface of this piece. It's really in-depth and interesting, and you can read the essay in full on Substack. You'll find a direct link on our homepage, eswek.org. Jim Branscombe, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard. And if you just joined us earlier in the hour, I talked with Renee Shaw about her retirement from KET and how she maintained a solid reputation for neutrality as a moderator of discussions with officials and leaders who often disagreed on policies and issues. And journalist James Branscombe walked us through his latest article about what's happened to local newspapers across Appalachia and why it matters. If you'd like to listen, you'll find those segments on our homepage at esweku.org. Lexington is about to underscore the unity and community with a couple of events. There's a Hands Across event set for Friday. Organizers hope to line up people from Versailles Road through downtown and out Winchester Road, with everybody linking hands at 12:15 and again at 12:45 in a show of unity. Then on Saturday, August 29th, Lexington-born jazz trumpeter, vocalist, composer, and educator Michael Cruz returns home from New York for a concert at the Isaac Murphy Memorial Art Garden. The evening is being called A Great Day in Lexington, inspired by the iconic 1958 photograph A Great Day in Harlem, which brought together 57 prominent jazz musicians. Joining us to talk about it are Jim Embry, community organizer, cultural activist, and co-founder of the Isaac Murphy Memorial Art Garden, and Michael Cruz, whose homecoming is the musical centerpiece for the evening. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you.
So, Jim, what are you inviting people to become part of on August 29th? And what did the photograph A Great Day in Harlem suggest as a model?
Okay. Thank you, Tom, so much. Again, as you mentioned, as the founder of the Murphy Art Garden and one of the board members of Phoenix Rising, Lex, we've had for the last 5 years this incredible Jazz from the Front Porch series, right there again at the Art Garden, which is the home foundation of this incredible jockey, Isaac Murphy, and his wife, Lucy. And there are all kinds of reports in the paper about them being quite the socialites in Lexington, having parties around the racing, hosting weddings for their friends who were jockeys and whatever else. And they always played music in the 1890s. So this is the fifth year. We've had Michael here before. A month or two ago, it was simply a jazz series featuring Michael Cruz. Then it became, the thought became, well, let's honor people who aren't simply deceased or your elders. Let's also honor and recognize, like Michael, young people. Then it became a Michael Cruz homecoming. The mayor is writing a proclamation. She'll be there. We've invited Senator Reginald Thomas and Representative George Brown. They're writing something. We've got some things coming in from Michael's alma mater, UC School of Music. We've got Visit Lex and Kingland's bringing out a big display of Black folk in the horse industry. And then we thought, like, wow, we're having the mayor there, people there from Kingland, Visit Lex, and whatever else. Let's have a photo op. And what better historical, wonderful examples you mentioned of the great day in Harlem to emulate than what we can do here, where we're inviting in, again, not just musicians and artists and public officials, but the whole community. And then, of course, we understand what happened where our wonderful sacred place of Charles Young Park, of the East End Day, that terrible, unimaginable possibility of shooting occurred. So now, with the mayor's blessing and the blessing of many people, divine karama, it's also becoming a day of restoring civility, a day of restoring peace, a day of healing. So it's become all of that right now. Mm-hmm. And we're just thankful that Michael speak about his contribution to all of that.
Well, Michael, I'm going to give our listeners a little bit of background on you for those who are not familiar with you. A lot of us are, but for those who are not, Michael comes from quite a rich musical background. It spans a century and includes notable Kentucky gospel groups like the Brooks Sisters, the Raglan Brothers. He studied under his uncle Charles Quillings, who also taught jazz pianist Les McCann. He went on to the UC Conservatory of Music, as Jim mentioned, and has shared stages with legendary acts like Roy Hargrove and the Charles Mingus Big Band, played on Broadway productions, and recorded with a diverse range of artists. And that's where Michael and I have a bit of a musical connection of our own. Michael performed on a recording by the Patrick McNeese Band that I was a member of at the time. And here's a portion of The Dream. It's from the album The Purple Door, featuring Michael. That's Michael Cruz on trumpet performing The Dream with the Patrick McNeese Band. Michael, your Lexington story includes Chester Grundy, who created opportunities for young people here to encounter major artists, including, in your case, none other than Wynton Marsalis. How important was Chester in opening that musical world to you?
Chester was definitely the key to opening everything that I could think of musically. I owe him a great deal, because if it wasn't for Chester, I wouldn't have been able to go backstage and meet Wynton for the first time. And then I later on got to meet him again in Eastern Kentucky University at their Performing Arts Center. It just changed my life being around him, hearing his sound, his music, and then meeting him backstage and the humility of the music. Those two moments were the defining moments that I was like, yeah, I want to do this in life. I want to continue to press on and do music. And also hearing my great uncle. I mean, he was everything in the music in Lexington, Kentucky. And so I'm so grateful for him.
And you're talking to us right now from the Lincoln Center, is that correct?
Not at the moment. I'm in Harlem. But yes, I do a lot of work at Lincoln Center. I play a lot at Dizzy's Club. Also work in education at Jazz at Lincoln Center, where we service all the five boroughs in New York. Also doing stuff with Christian McBride over at Jazz House Kids, and also doing stuff with the Louis Armstrong House Museum, which has been a total honor and dream as a Duke Community Outreach, and then also perform over there as an artist.
Jim, why is the Isaac Murphy Memorial Art Garden the right setting for this event? What becomes visible when Lexington's histories of music, horses, neighborhoods, and community life are all placed alongside one another?
Well, it's the right place for, a variety of reasons. You know, the East End was, at the Civil War, was one of those locations that African-Americans who were then emancipated settled in the East End. And they created community. They created churches, you know, businesses, restaurants, healthcare, created community right there in the East End. So it has that kind of a history. And in the development, because we'd already, as you know, been racing in Lexington on Main Street, okay? And the folks said, well, we got to get off of Main Street, and where can we go and have a horse track? Well, that was the East End at the old Kentucky racetrack. So within that milieu of building community, of course, you want to build social life, you want to build musical life. And then within the East End, what you call that old Dewey Street, is what arose as this Black business entertainment district.
When I came here, my great-grandfather was there too.
Yeah. When I came here in 67, Tom, there were like seven clubs, okay, on Dewey Street. One called the Hurricane Club, where all kind of Duke Madison, you know, Slim Jackson, Marshall Jones, and whatever else were playing. And of course, the Lyric was there as well, along with the local clubs. And the Lyric, as you know, has hosted all kinds of Black cultural talent. So, and also because, again, the site that we're have established, the Murphy Art Garden, named for Isaac Murphy and his wife, Lucy, and Memorial Mint, the whole community of people that made it possible, people like Isaac, to be on the horse. Women who sold the silks, made the saddles, people who baled the hay, who groomed the horses. It was all a community. And our wonderful dear friend, LaVon Williams, has carved pieces in the art garden now that symbolize the community. But again, Isaac and Lucy owned a big two-story called mansion there on the site now of the art garden that overlooked the old racetrack. And they were written up often as being quite the socialites, and oftentimes would host parties around racing, weddings, receptions. They played music, and we have the actual news articles describing what they were playing and what individuals played for them. So it's right for those reasons. Also, we've been involved at the Art Garden since 2006 as a way to use the Art Garden with young people and art and music and amphitheater. Les McCann, as you know, Tom, used to live right there on the East End, mm-hmm. off of 4th Street. And many people, again, the East End was this thriving, flourishing, safe neighborhood. So the Art Garden has been, again, created to help restore a sense of safety, civility, restoration. And the Art Garden has changed the entire city. Back when we formed the Art Garden, there were no faces of Black folk in the public image, okay, until the Art Garden and these wonderful art pieces featuring Murphy.
Michael, what does it mean to you to come back to Lexington for this event?
It means a great deal because my family, my great-grandfather, he lived on the house on Dewey's. Also, my great-great-grandfather was also a club owner in Lexington and a bootlegger. Can't really talk too deep on that one. But he lived over on Ohio Avenue. And all my family, they went to First African right there, on you know, and it means a great deal to come back to the community that has poured into me to allow me to be the person that I am, to allow me to go on and play all over the world. I'm scheduled to go to many different countries this year and be able to play this trumpet, this horn that, you know, when I first heard my great uncle Charles Quillins play, I was like, that's it. That's what I want to do. That sound, that passion that he had. And I still have his trumpet right behind me here in Harlem. And it's significant because I live in Harlem. I'm living about a block away from where the actual Great Day in Harlem photo was shot.
Oh, no kidding. Wow.
I live on 127th and 5th Ave. That's on 126th and 5th. Huh. And so I can get there in 2 minutes. So it's a very significant reason. I want to come back and bring the community and everybody together and say, hey, this is a time for us to come together and be a part of the music and share love and be about East End and also Lexington as a whole.
Okay, Jim, when should people get there? Yes. And what can they expect during the evening?
The concert runs from 6 to 8, But because of the photograph we're doing and Mayor Gorton's timing, we're saying about 5:45, folks should begin to gather, but who want to be in the photograph. And at about 6 p.m. sharp, we're going to be assembling everybody that's there. Well, welcome to be in the photograph. And then about 6:05, the mayor will read her proclamation. And then we'll have a few other readings from people. And then about 6:15, 6:20, it's going to be Michael music time. And then we'll run probably into about 8:15.
All right, that's community organizer and cultural activist Jim Embry. He's co-founder of the Isaac Murphy Memorial Art Garden, and Lexington-born jazz trumpeter, vocalist, composer, and educator Michael Cruz. A Great Day in Lexington takes place Saturday, August 29th at the Isaac Murphy Memorial Art Garden. The community photograph, as Jim just said, begins at 6 p.m., followed by recognitions and then music from Michael. Thank you both for joining us, and we'll see you on the 29th.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. See Love you, y'all.
In next week's edition of Eastern Standard, Bill Goodman and primary care physician Jeff Fox will debut their new series, Healthy Aging. Their guest is Dana Smith, who reports and writes for the New York Times about all kinds of things having to do with getting on in the years.
When you talk to kind of the really out there longevity scientists, they say, oh, everyone can live to 120. And I think very few people actually want to do that. They just, you know, want to be as healthy as they can be for as long as possible.
And some best ways to accomplish that.
Exercise really just seems to be the number one thing that I hear over and over again from scientists and doctors, of just the best thing that you can do for your health long term.
Lots of ground to cover as this series moves forward, from whether to be wary of the boom in brain health supplements and some ways to cut your risk of stroke, dementia, and depression, to ways millennials now in their 40s can plan ahead for the inevitable stuff that comes with aging. Bill and Jeff have lots more ideas for their new Eastern Standard series, Healthy Aging, starting with next week's edition. And yours are more than welcome. Just type aging in the subject line and send it to es@eku.edu. Also next week, the remarkable story of Emily Hackney, born into a Pentecostal family and church in the mountain town of Tazewell, Virginia. Thing about Emily is, she's an achiever.
I actually got into Harvard. It was so surreal, it almost didn't have meaning until I actually experienced it for myself.
We'll talk with Emily Hackney about her New York Times bestselling memoir, All That's Unseen. And Louisville attorney Brian Hera will take us into the pages of his book, Bourbon Justice, How Whiskey Law Shaped America. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced by WEKU and Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer. Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're on the WEKU, Apple, Spotify, and NPR apps. You can stream all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while you're there, you can check out our contributors and their interview archives. Send thoughts and suggestions to es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard.